Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Luxman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. My name is Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on www.irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network, USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. So, whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáilte isteach. For those of you who don't already know, Luxman Ireland House is NYU's Center for Irish and Irish American Studies, inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Luxman and Loretta Brennan Luxman. Luxman Ireland House NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned center for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since our founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, I hope you had a good week. I have to say that our presence at the 257th St. Patrick's Day Parade here in New York City was a lot of fun. We were out in big numbers. I reckon there were about 150 of us marching behind our brand new Luxman Ireland House banner. It was our first time marching, representing NYU, and it was lovely to be there in support of our co-founder and patron, Loretta Brennan Luxman. And she did a great job and did us all proud with her stellar ambassadorial skills during the parade. And we had a lot of fun. We had some of our members present, we had some of our alumni, our faculty, and our current students. And I have to say, it was a very memorable occasion. We were led up Fifth Avenue by members of the NYU Pipe Band, and they did an absolutely great job leading us up. It was rather cold, I have to say, waiting to take off, but once we got out into the sun, it was really a lot of fun. Now, speaking about the parade reminds me of the theme of this week's show. Loretta was led up the avenue in a horse-drawn carriage, and it got me thinking about a podcast produced by my colleague Linda Dowling Almeida a couple of years ago, and I thought it was a fitting opportunity to share that podcast with you. In this podcast, Linda delves into the horse carriage industry in New York City and uncovers some of the history of this old tradition. Loretta was very proud to be led up Fifth Avenue by one of the Irish horse carriage drivers, and her grandson Liam sat up front. Liam has a great passion for all things equestrian, and he did a great job and took his role very seriously in that regard. So I thought it was a nice tie-in this week to delve into the archives and have a listen to Linda Dowling Almeida's lovely work on this theme. Now, before we go to that, I want to remind you that our next public event takes place on Thursday, March 29th at 7 p.m. Now, folks, I want you to note that it will not take place at Luxman Ireland House. It will actually take place in the King Juan Carlos Greening Room, which is at 53 Washington Square South, just on the south side of the park from us. And this event is co-sponsored by our friends over in Hebrew and Judaic Studies. The title of the event is From Abie's Irish Rose to Anne O'Reilly's Rabbi Jake, the Irish-Jewish Couple in Feature Films. Professor Emeritus of Modern Jewish History at San Diego State University, Lawrence Barron, will speak on how American feature films about Irish and Jewish romances have conveyed varying messages, from extolling the melting pot ideal, exposing interethnic tensions, epitomizing interfaith toleration, reflecting changing gender roles, and embracing multicultural diversity. The lecture will trace the evolution of how these relationships have been depicted, from early films like Abe's Irish Rose to more recent ones like Keeping the Faith, and will be illustrated with clips from a number of these motion pictures. Barron has authored and edited 4 books, including The Modern Jewish Experience in World Cinema and Projecting the Holocaust into the Present, The Changing Focus of Contemporary Holocaust Cinema. He is currently working on the history of how and why the Oscars have honored films about the Holocaust. As I mentioned, this event is co-sponsored by NYU's Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies, and we're delighted to collaborate with our colleagues in that center. So that sounds like a really great program. Professor Barron is, by all accounts, a great speaker. And if any of you are interested in that event, please do go to our website, where you will be prompted to where you can register for that event. Now, the following Friday, we have a Blarney Star concert. We had one last night, and we have another one on Friday, April 6th. Moira Ní Cathaisigh and Chris Newman will perform at Luxman Ireland House. In the 1980s, West Cork native Moira Ní Cathaisigh pioneered a modern traditional music style on the harp, introducing the dance music repertoire, rhythm and ornamentation associated with fiddle, pipes and flute to her instrument, and helping to explode the stereotype of the Irish harpist as a gowned performer of semi-classical parlour music. She found a musical and life partner in the massively talented English guitarist Chris Newman, and together they have created a unique string sound duo that combines traditional melodic roots and modern music sensibility. So, great combination, folks, and I'm sure some really nice music. That is the 6th of April. And just to continue that, on Thursday, April 12th, our former colleague here, Abby Bender, will come and speak. The title of her topic is Irish-Jewish Studies at the Border: From Poetry to Politics, the Widespread Irish Belief That the Irish and the Jews Had Suffered More Than Other People Persisted into the First Decade of the 20th Century, When Indeed It Was So Common As to Be Cliché. This analogy, like so many other transcultural and transnational discourses of solidarity, has changed dramatically over the past century. Dr. Abby Bender will examine this shifting history through 2 texts, Joyce's 1922 novel Ulysses and Ruth Gilligan's 2016 novel Nine Folds Makes a Paper Swan. These texts, read in the context of contemporary discourses of border crossing, wall building and changing notions of citizenship, help us explore the possibilities, limits and ironies of the Irish-Jewish analogy and the tensions and richness of cross-cultural analysis. It'll be great to have Abby back at Luxman Ireland House. And again, if you want some more information on that or on any events, please go to our website. Just put in Luxman Ireland House NYU into your search engine, or plug in www.as.nyu.edu/Ireland House. AS denotes arts and sciences. So now we'll go into our podcast on the horse carriage industry. So enjoy, folks.
Enjoying the ride, the Irish and the New York City horse and carriage industry, then and now. In early 2014, horses made headlines for months in New York City following the inauguration of Mayor Bill de Blasio. The mayor made it his mission to shut down the horse and carriage industry in Central Park, claiming that pulling carriages all year round was tantamount to animal abuse and that city streets were no place for horses. The industry is comprised of 220 licensed horses, and 300 licensed drivers, about 160 of whom are active, as well as 68 licensed carriages. Defenders on both sides of the issue were passionate and impassioned. Celebrities like Liam Neeson advocated for the carriage industry, while Alec Baldwin called for its demise. Editorial boards of the city's primary newspapers took sides. The debate became political when carriage drivers claimed the mayor was rewarding campaign supporters in the real estate industry who wanted the land currently occupied by the stables on the west side of Manhattan because of their valuable location. In December 2014, the City Council introduced a bill that called for the non-renewal of industry licenses, which would effectively shut down the trade within 2 years if it passed. For the time being, the public can still enjoy a ride around the park, but the controversy illuminates a feature of city life that is centuries old. Horses have had a presence in urban New York from its earliest beginnings, and at least since the mid-19th century, the Irish have been handling the horses that powered the city. Questions about the suitability of horses on city streets are also not new. As the automotive industry grew at the turn of the 20th century, activists clamored to send horses back to the pasture, citing safety and sanitation concerns, and again the Irish found themselves at the center of the controversy. 100-plus years later, the horses still clop through Manhattan, and they are more than likely handled and shod by Irishmen. We talked to some members of the horse and carriage business in New York, as well as Hilary Sweeney, a scholar who has researched the history of the urban workhorse and the Irish in New York. All these interviews are deposited in the oral history collection of the Archives of Irish America here at NYU.
What we're going to do here is we're going to demonstrate the shoeing of a horse and a hind. And the first thing we want to do is make sure the horse is situated correctly. So right here, Michael, as you see, he is very much up against the wall. I don't want him to lean on the wall because then it's too much weight on me. So the thing I want to do is to get him off the wall. And by the way, my name is Edward Hayes. I'm a third-generation horseshoer. Farrier. My grandfather was a horseshoer, came from Ireland, and shod horses here for 40 years, mostly commercial, mostly during the 20s and 30s and 40s. And my father succeeded him, Edward Hayes, and now I'm the third generation farrier. For your record, I have 30 years experience in the trade. So the first thing we want to do is make sure, as I said to you, Michael, the horse is comfortable. So right now I got him in a spot where he's comfortable. Then what I want to do is I have to pull the shoe. So the first thing we want to do is clear out the debris, all the debris. And then what we want to do is loosen the shoe. So there's less stress on the horse when I pull the shoe.
Well, the primary thoughts about the Irish in New York at that time was that they were almost refugees from Ireland. There were people who had moved over from before the big famine of in the mid-1840s, but even before then, when there were smaller famines.
Hilary J. Sweeney, scholar.
People had been moving from Ireland from the 1820s, 30s, 40s. So by the time the 1860s rolled around, there was quite a large number of Irish people who had suffered deprivation in Ireland and who had moved to the New World looking for something better. And they really had all the characteristics of people who had troubled backgrounds, but had certain skills that gave them advantages. They were prepared to work hard, clearly, and they also kept close ties to other Irish people. And they were they set up homes together, and they worked together primarily to create a new world or new lives for themselves. Horses have always been sort of in the Irish experience, whether in towns or in rural areas. Even for me growing up, and I grew up in a city in the west of Ireland, horses were part of city life. In the countryside in those days, going back to the mid-19th century, I'd imagine that horses were, first of all, they were the primary mode of transport. People either walked, which they called shanks mare, which was a way of walking, to get from A to B, or they had horses and carriages or ponies and carts or whatever. So the Irish people were not... horses were not foreign to them. They were a normal part of life. There were certainly would have been employment opportunities in the large estates for young Irish people working with horses. But there was also horse racing. Horse racing was a big part of Irish life and has been documented going back through, you know, all forms of Irish literature. There's horses pop up here and there. Going back to the earliest stories that we have that came through the Beledis or the storytelling tradition, a lot of them circle around horses. So I don't think moving to a city where horses were the primary source of power and then needed care, I don't think it would have been a leap at all for Irish people to move into that kind of an area of work.
Yeah, well, I grew up on a farm where we didn't have horses. The horses had just about started to die down. My father bought a tractor in 1957. He was one of the first people in the west of Ireland in our place to have a tractor.
Connor McHugh, stable owner and carriage driver.
And because of that, he got a lot of work, basically where his neighbours would come to him just asking him, can you come and mow my meadow or plough my field or whatever, because it's so much quicker for you to do it than it is for us to, you know, to use the horse.
What county?
So, County Leitrim. It's in the northwest of Ireland. And then he, again by virtue of the fact that he had a tractor, got a milk run where they were bringing the milk to the dairy or creamery, the locals on horse and cart, and again it was difficult and slow, a tedious process, and they would take turns doing it, each farmer, and one of them then asked him if he would do it, and you got paid like a penny or a halfpenny per gallon, but it was a nice little job to have. It was a job when, you know, in addition to being a farmer, so it was something that was really helpful, and he did that right up. He died in 1983, but he did that up until 1980 when he sort of started getting sick and passed away. He still, all of his brothers and sisters had gone to England or America, one or two of them in Dublin, and he was planning to go to England in 1959, but his sister who was in England gave him some money so he could buy a brand new tractor, and that that saved the day. That's why I'm talking with the accent that I'm talking with. So he was able to stay home and expand his business. But the horses, by the time I was born in 1964, there was a few horses on different farms. Our neighbour was still using a horse, and I remember them bringing hay in with their horse and that, but really only as a very small child. So time progressed, and the horses were kind of just hanging around in some cases. Our other neighbour had a horse. We used to go up and jump up on his back and ride him in the field, and our neighbour would get mad at us for that. But he really wasn't using them anymore, and they got sold off as the tractor just came in. And eventually, time progressed. I graduated college in Ireland in the early 80s, and it was very difficult to get a job at that time. Everyone was leaving the west of Ireland in particular. If you weren't going to America, you know, people were saying, when are you going? And I took the boat took the plane to America. My teacher in college used to come over here to New York every summer as a student and then as an actual professor and drive a carriage every summer. Oh. And he had told us about how he used to do this. So when I came over, I got a job immediately in construction, but I was working outside, inside Trump Tower, but we used to come out and sit on the sidewalk to eat lunch, and I seen a carriage going down Fifth Avenue. So I ran over, I didn't know where Central Park was, even though it was two blocks from where I was walking. I ran over and talked to Jesse. You don't remember, I don't know, Jesse, he was a Filipino. And asked him where was the Irish stable, and he told me it was on 37th Street. So after I finished work, I took walking down to 37th Street, where I met Neil Burns, who still owns that stable on 37th Street, another Irish American. I was lucky in a couple of ways. His mother was from Leitrim. And on the day that I got there, he didn't really have a job, but there was a veterinarian just there whose name was Conor McMahon. And because we just shared, he was also from Ireland, and because we seemed to just share a first name, we kind of just bonded immediately. And then it turned out that he went to school with our local veterinarian in Leitrim, that they were in the same class in UCD in Dublin. So we talked about that, and he took a liking to me. And when Neil Burns was kind of saying, "Oh, maybe I have a job," he said, "Oh, you got to hire this kid. And he did. So I became a carriage driver in September of 1986. And I still planned at that time that I would move back to Ireland probably after Christmas. Of course, a lot of Christmases have come and gone, and I'm still here.
My father was then driving a horse-drawn cab during the Second World War here.
Cornelius Neil Byrne, stable owner and carriage driver.
And the money was flowing. They say these carriage drivers made a tremendous amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And
it,
once again, a lot of Irish guys. So I was born, of course, in 1946 up in the west side of Manhattan. And at that time, my father was driving a taxi cab.
A car. A motor vehicle, yes.
But before that, he had been driving a horse in Central Park also.
Mm-hmm.
And he had some accident with his horse, and so something went wrong there, and he drove a taxi cab instead.
Horses were the source of power in all areas of industry.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you think of immediately, one thinks of just moving goods, moving people, first of all, moving goods. The population of the city was growing. Food had to be moved in. The horses had to move people around the city. Horses also had to move waste materials out of the city. So there was a traffic flow in and out of the city all the time. The horses that lived in the city, and there were stables all over the city, they also had to be fed. So the food had to come in from the farms, and horses pulled the food in. And the waste products of horses, manure and everything, had to be gathered by the carters and taken out of the city back to the farms. So there was a constant move. Then even within the city, on the docks, and as you know, there's docks all around Manhattan. It's a city of docks. All the cranes were operated by horsepower. Horses powered the cranes. Horses, as buildings were built for horses, stables, they were stables with maybe 8 levels. And horses operated the elevators that pulled horses up and down in the stables. So everything. So you had working horses at all different levels.
Yeah.
Supporting each other as they supported the city. And they were the only source of power in industry. It was all horsepower.
Huh.
And so, they were from the middle of the 19th century up to the end of the 19th century, the number of horses in the city was growing at an exponential rate. I have it somewhere here, but I think it moved from something like 20,000 to 90,000 over 50 years. That's a huge number of horses. And those horses had to be cared for. They had to be fed. And not only that, but when they got old and died, they had to be dealt with. And so there were teams of horses, of gatherers of carcasses of dead horses to take to the west side where there were tanneries. Horses sometimes dropped dead in the street.
Yeah.
You know, and needed to be removed. And so the other horses came along and took them away.
Well, the Clinton Park Stables actually was opened in 2003. This building had been built to be a stable back in the 1860s, but it had gone through a timeline where the New York City Sanitation Department kept our horses here that they used to clean the streets at that time. Most of the cleaning in the streets was cleaning up other horses' manure. That was the main problem, if you want, from a sanitation standpoint. At some stage, obviously, they went mechanical.
Okay.
My father passed away a little too soon for me. He passed away when I was 18, and so I took over his carriage business, you know. Although I had bought licenses on my own at 17, I had enough money to buy one, and I bought one. I remember I had this amount of money, and I had the choice of either buying a lot out in Huntington, Long Island, or buying a horse carriage medallion license. Mm-hmm. And I took the horse carriage medallion license, you know. Mm-hmm. So I had one of these things since I was 17. My brother is 2 years and 8 months older.
Okay. Yeah. And is he in the carriage business?
He's in the carriage business,
really?
Too.
Okay.
Yeah. And he never chose to get as deeply involved in it as I did, you know. Because I went and bought these buildings and took a chance on things like that, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I bought the first building over there on 11th Avenue in 1976.
Now, a couple of things I want to point out to you. The nail, you can see where the points are. Points to the outside. So the checker on the head is on the inside.
Okay.
When you apply the nails have to come out of the hoof. So they have to be what's called clinched, filed down, and that's a part of finishing and holding the shoe on.
Got
As
it.
You can see in the front feet, we applied nails. Those nails all came out. They have to come out, because if they don't come out, it's incorrect nailing. Then we apply finishing. We clinch the hoof, shoe, and then we rasp and we file it down, which I'm going to demonstrate to you. But the way the nails are made for a horse is they point to the outside.
One of the young Irish horse handlers of the 19th century who is representative of the livelihood horses provided for the Irish was Michael Hallinan. He emigrated in 1861 from Galway, began as a farrier, built a horseshoe business, and actually invented a rubber horseshoe pad to help animals navigate the wet and frozen cobblestones that paved city streets at the time. His original stable and the building he commissioned as his business grew can still be found on Barrow Street in Greenwich Village. His stable is now the location of one of the city's most romantic restaurants, one if by land, two if by sea. And his building up the street still bears his initials and the horse head and horseshoe icons that recall the street's history. Remnants of that horse-powered era can be found elsewhere around Manhattan. Washington Mews, on which Ireland House sits, was originally built as a row of stables. Il Cantinori, the lovely Italian restaurant on East 10th Street, was a stable. And the Grosvenor Stables farther west on 10th still bear the name of its original occupiers. The past presence of the horse industry exists all around Manhattan.
And so many industries then grew up around them, too. I mean, because you had to have all the equipment for horses. You had to have the halters, the carts, the brushes for cleaning them, all of these items that you need for horses. The horseshoeing industry began to grow hugely. Of course, we know the blacksmith industry grew.
As you saw before in the article, my grandfather came from Ireland, and he worked the commercial horse business for 50 years. He died at 70 years old, but he worked for the express company where he was in Jersey City, where he was a supervisor of 100 horseshoers.
Eddie Hayes, farrier.
And in those days, a supervisor wasn't a person that walked around and made sure everybody was working. Everybody was working because there was such an urgency to deliver goods to people's, to retail stores as well as people's houses. So he was actually working a forge or working a horse, back and forth. When that closed because of vehicles and gasoline and electricity for trains, he went and he had a shop in Jersey City where a dozen guys were working for him. In those days, it was all guys and gals. And he worked at most of the guys that worked for my dad, I would say all the guys were Irish guys. Most of the guys that worked for my granddad were also from Ireland. So when he came to America, he had a skill and a trade already. He went right away to work for the Express Company.
So was your dad surprised that there was a business firm with that trade?
Yeah, it was like hitting the lottery.
Yeah.
And then in 1964, he took the police test in 1976.
Stephen Malone, carriage driver.
And he almost got into a very heated discussion, we'll say, with the chief that was running, because my dad walked in a jacket and tie and a bag of tools. Everybody else was coming with these fancy trucks and stuff like that. So the guy says, well, what are you doing here? He says, I'm here to take the test. He goes, take the test? Like that? He goes, my tie comes off. Yeah, take the test. So then they gave him, there's a difference in the way the shoes are shaped.
When you mean a test to work for the police department?
Yes.
Not to be an officer.
To be the farrier. And horse's hooves are shaped differently from front to back.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they're more round in the front and a little bit more narrow in the back.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave him, and the shoes are shaped differently, obviously, as well, to fit the shoes. So he gave him a hind shoe to put on the front. And my father says, well, you gotta be kidding me. He says, it's a hind shoe, you don't put it in the front. Oh, no, just put it on, just do as you're told. The guy says, my father says, well, absolutely not do as I'm told. I says, you're doing a test here for the police department. You don't even know what you're talking about. And he was the only one. He got 100%. He was the only one out of 150 people.
Everything was a test.
Everything was a test.
Well, the carting, originally, it was just a cart man. And a cart man was a man and a cart, basically. And his job was to go around cleaning up the mess. Usually the mess was left behind by a horse. And their job was to clean it up. And any other mess. And that first carting job became a horse and cart job. And therefore the man with the cart was replaced by a horse and cart and a handler. What happened was, with the influx of the Irish, and this was the lowest job you could have, cleaning up the manure around the city streets. It was on the bottom rung of jobs, or at least one of the ones on the bottom. But there were so many Irish going into it that it was decided, the city was getting a little perturbed about this, and so it was decided that carters would have to have a license issued to them. And you could only have a license issued to you if you were a citizen.
Mm.
And so the licenses for carting were awarded to New Yorkers, and then they subcontracted the actual work of doing the carting to the Irish. Primarily to the Irish. So you had Irishmen working as cartmen, but they could never really reap the benefit of the profits of the job because they were employees.
Huh.
And so they could not get licenses themselves. A further way of inhibiting the Irishman from getting a license was licenses were allowed to be inherited, and so there wasn't really a way in for an Irish carter, and it kind of tied that up a little bit. But moving on from there, the carters did sort of recognise that they had a little bit of political power, in that carting was a very important job in a sense. It may not have had much status, but keeping the streets clean at that time, when you have 60,000 horses wandering around the southern Manhattan, was an important job. And so they managed to align themselves politically together, along with other handlers of horses who, you know, became known as teamsters once they could handle a team of horses.
Yeah. So 5 years after I became a driver, myself and Michael Garra bought a carriage medallion together. Michael Garra was from Dublin. He owned the night half and I owned the day half. And he had his own horse and I had my horse. And he would drive his horse at night, I would drive mine in the daytime. And then about 5 or 6 years later, he decided to move back to Ireland and become an organic farmer. And then I bought his half of the share of the carriage, and then I owned all of the medallion, which there are 68 medallions
total
issued by the city. We still haven't been able to fully
grasp
when they were issued. I think talking about Whitehall, and it's not, it's extremely difficult to get a taxi license, not extremely, but it's quite difficult to get a taxi driver's license. But it's going back again to what we talked a bit about the rates and that, how nearly all of the rules that were in place for us were really old, because nobody had bothered to change how you get a horse driver's license, because it sort of had very quickly with the automobiles kind of just moved over, and everyone then started saying, oh, let's make the rule for the automobile, and the rule for the horse was never changed, it just sat there, but nobody bothered. And it changed then and became a more difficult process. Like Christina said, for her it wasn't so difficult because she had familiarity, but some drivers who come, or some potential drivers, now have difficulty passing it because they're new to it, and it's a little tricky, and you have to know all the different parts of a horse. We kind of don't really agree with it in that we don't see how knowing the sort of veterinarian names for the different parts of the horse is going to help you be a better driver.
Yeah, the SPCA, when it was set up to, as we know, to protect horses. At the time that it was set up, there was this new view coming into vogue that that horses, or that any animals really, should be looked after, and that they had a different role than that of a machine. And so it was set up with the best of intentions, of course. I think that there is some evidence that somehow that may have turned out. It was a good thing, of course, but it turned out that horses in New York at that time could only be euthanized by a veterinarian or a representative of the SPCA. So there's some question about whether or not their intentions were perhaps, maybe just taken a little bit too far, in that they could assist in the euthanizing of animals which were not wanted anymore. And therefore, which would then lead to the payout of an insurance claim rather than, just letting a horse live out its final days. So there's a lot of evidence that the ASPCA actually was responsible for the majority of the deaths of horses in New York City during that time.
Advocates on both sides of the debate to keep horses in the city in Berg's era and today insist that their primary concern is the safety and health of the animals. It is clear that horses inspire emotions from all sides: owners, drivers, handlers, carriage riders, animal activists, and interested observers. In the current atmosphere, when horsepower is no longer a commercial or personal necessity to literally keep the city moving, the source of those emotions is ironically more complex. Admittedly, the horses provide a living for the hundreds of people and their families that keep the carriages circling through the park, and that can't be discounted. But emotionally, the removal of horses from the streets severs a link to our past, and that can affect a lot more people.
Well, I think it must have been back with the opening of Central Park that it all started, because when Central Park was devised, it was thought about and built, when you think about it, and there's some interesting artwork showing the construction of Central Park, and all the horses and carts in there, and all the workers creating this beautiful park. But the park was designed for the elite members of New York to enjoy. And so once the park was opened, only those who had carriages, horses and carriages, were allowed in there to enjoy the countryside as it was created. So the horses and carts that had been in there as workers for 2 years previously were then suddenly not allowed in anymore. It was only those that had horses and carriages. So driving around in your horse and carriage became a leisure activity at the weekends for the richer New Yorkers. Now, poorer New Yorkers were allowed in on foot to watch and to look at and enjoy watching the beautiful horses trotting by. So that became an activity, became a leisure time activity for the wealthier members of the community. And I suppose then, coming from that, those who didn't actually have their own horse and cart or horse and carriage, the development of rides and being able to pay to go for a ride would have come from that, and going, and in Central Park particularly, which of course is still going on today.
People, of course, were going there, but they also wanted to be driven through the park.
Mm-hmm.
Olmsted designed the park for carriage driving, first and foremost. I mean, carriage driving, riding, and walking.
Christina Hansen, carriage driver.
And so the first thing they built in the park, it took them 20 years to build it, and, although it was opened in 1858, well, the whole thing was still under construction, but the first thing they built was the carriage drive.
Huh.
And most people in New York City did not have horses. The only people that really had horses were people that were fabulously rich or worked with horses on a daily basis, whether it's cab drivers, freight guys, you know, et cetera, delivery guys. So even your average middle class or even fairly well-off New Yorker didn't have horses. But the park was designed to be seen from the back of a carriage. So they would go up to 59th Street and ask the cabbie there, you know, drive me through the park for a while. So that's actually how the kind of tourism, you know, it's been, because some people sort of make this mistake and they say, well, you know, Central Park was built in the era of horses, so of course there were carriages there. It's just that, you know, we just switched over to cars. No, there was always this attraction of going to the park, hiring a carriage, and being driven around through it, because most people, including the locals, and then of course if you're from out of town, even if you had horses back on the farm in Indiana or whatever,
mm-hmm.
You know, this was something to do, was to go see the park in a cab.
It certainly, though, was transportation in addition
to.
It was transportation that people sort of used recreationally.
Yeah.
But up until when I was started as a driver in 1986, and up until 1990, if you were a horse and carriage driver, you could leave the stable. If somebody hailed you, just like you would hail a taxi at the corner of 52nd Street on 11th Avenue, and said, take me to Brooklyn City Hall, I
could
do it.
That?
I could legally do it. I was violating absolutely no rule by doing it. I had the same license or privilege to do that as a taxi cab.
Did you ever do that?
No, I never did that. We had it had become by then, to a large extent, a ride in the park idea. However, we did work at Rockefeller Center, and on wet days, as I'm sure you still know, if you're trying to get a taxi on a wet day, it's nearly impossible. And on wet days, we would find that people didn't want to ride in Central Park in general if it was raining, you know, people kind of scattered out of the park and away, you know, went for lunch, whatever. And we would then, some of us as drivers, would just drive our horses over by, say, the Plaza Hotel, where they, by then there'd be a line waiting for taxis. And if somebody was going a relatively short distance, maybe Grand Central or Penn Station or somewhere like that, they would say, oh, let me hop in the carriage. You know, they could jump out of the line and jump into the carriage. And I frequently took people to Grand Central and to Penn Station.
So you're like a midtown kind of thing.
Yeah, sort of a midtown type thing that was sort of reasonable. In 1990, by then that was when the sort of the whole animal rights thing was starting to become an issue, and they passed restrictions then on which they imposed on the medallion, but it was because of the horse. You know, they said, oh, well, we don't want the horse going across bridges and tunnels and this and that. So that was when we started getting restricted in the times that we could do this and that sort of taxi rides, as we used to call them. So we became more sort of just a pleasure ride. But you know, but we had that ability from the get-go.
So now we're filing.
And you can see Michael.
Rub your hand across there. Dream is done. Dream is complete. Ready for work.
That's how I learned first, though. I knew every single tool. I knew.
Yeah.
I anticipated the next to this, to that. Move the box.
Swash, yeah.
That was tremendous. The best teacher I ever had.
Father?
I graduated from Billy Dickens University. I was a counting major. But
yeah.
The best professor I ever had was my dad.
Carriage debate has forced many of us to recognize just how connected the Irish are to the horse industry. Consider these examples in the culture. Peter Barron's book, The Law of Dreams, features a young famine immigrant who survives and thrives because of his expertise with horses. Red Pollard, the jockey who rode Seabiscuit to fame and national prominence in the 1930s, was born into an Irish family in Canada, and the Rooney family of the Pittsburgh Steelers fame manages Yonkers Raceway in New York, which was originally opened for thoroughbred racing in 1907 by James Butler of County Kilkenny as Empire City Racetrack.
I think that's the way some industries go. I mean, I think we'd find it in other maybe cultural or ethnic groups as well. Once a pattern is set in place, I mean, people tend to follow that pattern. And so probably jobs, you know, people arrange jobs for family members maybe, or friends, or they look after their own. And I'd imagine it's just something as simple as that, going on from over 100 years, 150 years ago, when the Irish started working, you know, were the primary group working in the as the support system for the horsepower of the city, for the living machines of New York City. That simply just continued, I would say, and it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense when an ethnic group sets itself up and become the best at doing that job by virtue of their experience and being able to hand that experience on from family member to family member. That does make sense to me, and it doesn't surprise me in the least that the handlers of the horses in Central Park today are Irish, or of Irish heritage.
It started out to be a source of employment, of course, you know, there was nothing else in the way of transport to look at but a horse. But the Irish come from farms, they come from rural communities, they're used to being around animals, they're good horsemen, they celebrate horses in Ireland, it's in the blood, you know. Even the John Wayne movie that we talked about before, you know, horses are always a constant part of Ireland, and it's there, it's in the blood.
As Hilary Sweeney will tell you, horses are still part of the culture in urban and rural Ireland today. Young Irish who grew up with horses continue to enter New York City looking for work, and at least for now can find a place for themselves in the horse carriage industry of the 21st century. While horses are not integral to the business of powering New York industry, they still cater to all New Yorkers and tourists who want to escape the rumble of city streets and enjoy the park the way Frederick Olmsted intended it to be seen, from the back of a carriage. And as long as they are working, the horses will continue to need the handlers, drivers, and stable owners, many of them Irish, who keep them healthy and happy and ready to work.
I suppose it's sort of a sentimental, maybe a sentimental thing, a nostalgia for something of the past when life was simpler.
Mm-hmm.
People moved at a slower rate and took their time and enjoyed the ride as opposed to just a journey being something to be completed as quickly as possible to get you from A to B. I mean, there's something about a carriage ride that is in itself an enjoyable thing, whether you're going anywhere in particular or if you're just going around in a circle and you end up back where you started. It's the nostalgia of that time, of that period when life was simpler and you didn't have to rush around. And it's sort of nice to listen to the clippity-clop of the hoofs. And I mean, the horses are such... you always have this idea of the horse as a docile and a kind of sympathetic creature.
Sure.
To the vagaries of its owner, you know, that does what it's told and you know. It's a different time. It transports people in time, perhaps.
For Glucksman Ireland House, this is Linda Dowling Almeida.
And on this week's show, folks, I'm going to share with you Mick Maloney's great tune, Kilkelly. It's a great nostalgic transatlantic ballad. Enjoy, folks.
Kilkelly, Ireland, 1860, my dear and loving son John. Your good friend, schoolmaster Pat McNamara, so good as to write these words down. Your brothers have all gone to find work in England, house was so empty and sad. Crop of potatoes is sorely infected, a third to a half of them back. And your sister Bridget and Patrick O'Donnell are going to be married in June. Your mother says not to work on the railroad and be sure to come on home soon. Kilkelly, Ireland, 1870, my dear and loving son John. Hello to your missus and to your four children. May they grow healthy and strong. Michael has got in a wee bit of trouble, I suppose, that he never will learn. Because of the dampness, there's no turf to speak of, and now we have nothing to burn. Bridget is happy, you named a child for her, although she's got sticks of her own. You say you found work, but you don't say what kind, or when you'll be coming home. I'm sorry to give you the very sad news that your dear old mother has gone. We buried her down at the church in Kilkelly. Your brothers and Bridget were there. Don't have to worry, she died very quickly. Remember her in your prayers. And it's so good to hear that Michael's returning. With money he's sure to buy land. For the crop has been poor and the people are selling at any price that they can. My dear and loving son John, I suppose that I must be close on 80, It's 30 years since you've gone. Because of all of the money you sent me, I'm still living out in my home. Michael has built himself a fine house, and Bridget's daughters are grown. Thank you for sending your family picture. They're lovely young women and men. You say that you might even come for a visit. What joy to see you again. Ireland 18 and 92, my dear brother John. I'm sorry I didn't write sooner to tell you that father passed on. He was living with Bridget, she says he was cheerful and healthy right down to the end. You should have seen him playing with the grandchildren at McNamara, your friend. And we buried him alongside of Mother down at Kilkelly churchyard. He was a strong and a feisty old man, considering his life so. And it's funny the way he kept talking about you. He called for you at the end. Oh, why don't you think about coming to visit? We'd all love to see you again.
And that was Mick Maloney and his song Kilkelly. We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nyhan, and I'd like to thank you for listening to the Glucksman Ireland House NYU Radio Hour. I'll be back again next Saturday, same time, on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flanley. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-producer, Levon Henry, our email is ireland.house@nyu.edu. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus the Nacht. Our theme music today is the opening set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassband and Real World Records.